Good morning. Good morning. The last day of APHA. Good morning. Good morning. Welcome to our session, Community Wayfinding in Public Health, Relevance, Research, and Promise. We are excited that you are here. Maybe we'll even get people on their feet after. I think we can do it. We have a really nice set of presentations to share with you and excellent speakers, so we're really glad that you're with us this morning. I'm Daniela Friedman from the University of South Carolina. I'll be moderating the session this morning, and I have no relationships to disclose. We have excellent presenters today. We have Dr. Linda Anderson from the CDC Healthy Aging Program, Dr. Anna Vandenberg from Emory University, and everyone is in order here, to my right, your left. We have Dr. Cindy Bryant from University of Colorado, Dr. Basha Belza, University of Washington, and Becky Hunter, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. This is an initiative of the CDC Healthy Aging Research Network, what we call the CDC HON. And so I wanted to present the member centers of the CDC HON. We have 7 member centers, with University of Washington as the coordinating center, and we have an affiliate center, which is University of Illinois at Chicago. We also have many, many, many partners and partner organizations of the Healthy Aging Research Network. So we're very excited to present this work, and a number of partners were involved in this wayfinding initiative. We do want to thank the CDC Healthy Aging Program for we're part of the Prevention Research Centers program for funding this program, and the funders of the Healthy Aging Research Network. And one of the wayfinding assessment projects was also funded by the National Association of Chronic Disease Directors, and we want to acknowledge them as well. As our dear friend and colleague, Becky Hunter, always says, it takes a network to do this type of work, and we are a network. The HON is an excellent network. And all of these people, and maybe more, if you can believe it, were involved in this wayfinding initiative. So it really does take a network, and as you will see by the comprehensive work that was done for this wayfinding initiative, it really did take this group of people. And we're very grateful to everybody. So today we're going to do a number of things. We're going to present a conceptual framework of relationships between wayfinding, mobility, and societal participation. We're going to share the comprehensive research that we looked at across many different disciplines about wayfinding. We'll share with you factors that enhance and detract from wayfinding in diverse older adults. Discuss the role of tools and technology that can facilitate community wayfinding, and also discuss priorities for public health policy and practice to improve community wayfinding. And we want to have a discussion at the end to get your input on where you think this work is going and implications for research and practice. So we look forward to having a nice discussion at the end of all of the presentations. But before we get started, I want to get your input right now, actually, to see what your experience is with wayfinding. So I'm just going to ask you to raise your hands or wave at me when I ask some of the following questions. You may have played the game Have You Ever in the past. These are different questions for the game Have You Ever. But have you ever asked for directions over and over again? Or even once? Okay. Didn't want to leave anybody out there. Have you ever missed a turn because of a potentially confusing road sign? You're welcome to raise 2 hands as well if you're really dedicated to the response. Have you ever come to a stop outside a transit station not knowing which way to turn? In the last mm-hmm. Who had trouble getting here to the shuttles or from the airport here to the convention center, etc.? Have you ever lost your car in a parking lot? I hope I know where I parked it at the airport when I get home later. Have you ever had trouble seeing an important sign? Have you ever been able to reach a pedestrian button, push button at an intersection when you're trying to cross the street? Excellent. Have you been frustrated because there has not been a button? Okay. Have you had to turn back, change your route, because there might have been a gap in a sidewalk when you're taking a stroll? Have you had trouble figuring out where to cross a busy highway or road? Okay. Have you ever been totally overloaded with information? Can I raise my hands and my feet for that one? Okay, so a lot of hands for that one. Well, if you raised your hand at least once or answered yes to at least one of those questions, you're at the right session. If you didn't raise your hand at all, that's okay. We need your input on how we can improve wayfinding for older adults, for people with disability, for everyone. So with that, I want to turn it over to Dr. Linda Anderson, director of the CDC Healthy Aging Program, to talk about a conceptual framework for wayfinding.
Good morning, and thank you very much. We're delighted to be here this morning and be able to put on this special panel, and I just want to acknowledge the authors of this particular abstract. I also don't have any relationships to disclose, and the goals of this presentation are, one, to introduce wayfinding as a public health issue. I think Daniela did a great job sort of talking how it has relevance to all of us and meaning in our life. I also want to raise awareness about the pivotal role of wayfinding as an aid to identifying factors that may serve as facilitators or barriers to people being physically active or being engaged in their communities, and then also to think about stimulating new integrative and interdisciplinary research and practice ideas by looking at this conceptual framework. So one of the things that's important is there's growing recognition that where people live and where we spend our time affects our health as well as our well-being. And so we think about this as the place, and I think place is really a concept in public health that is getting a lot of attention and people recognize it. And it's important for a number of reasons. One is it's getting really access for people to goods and services. It's also important and provides opportunities as well as sometimes barriers for thinking about healthful behaviors of getting out in the community, of walking. And then it also provides prospects of what we like to think about as civic and social engagement. And so getting people out in the community and making a difference in their communities. And place affects all of those as well as many others. So our particular work that we were interested in looking at focuses on this concept of wayfinding, which is integral to place but has received relatively little attention compared to the concept of place. And so I'll introduce to you the concept, sort of the origins and the definition of wayfinding. Kevin Lynch, who was an American urban planner as well as a well-known author, introduced the concept of wayfinding more than 50 years ago. And so I think that's an important, it's really been around for a long time as a concept and being thought about. But he did this as part of a call to rebuild our increasingly complex cities, thinking about where we live. And this was done 50 years ago, as we think about. And he was really concerned about residents and visitors being able to navigate easily and move freely in these increasingly more complex kinds of environments. And so really our definition that we use of wayfinding is the process by which people locate themselves. And that's a very important concept, locating yourself in that sense of place, as well as then being able to find your way in those community settings. So it's both in location as well as being able to navigate through that location. So we developed a conceptual framework for a number of reasons. One, we wanted to provide a context and think about those things that both influence wayfinding as well as those things that have an impact on public health outcomes. So we use a sociological framework for thinking about those influences. Then we describe to you some key influences of the actual process of wayfinding, which you'll see some of the literature in a minute that looks at those issues. And then we have tried to articulate a clear set of public health outcomes. I would love at the end of this, as we have our discussion, to get feedback about our conceptual framework, how we're thinking about this, as well as our findings. So we begin with really thinking about the social ecological model, and I just would like to see a set of hands of everyone who's familiar with the social ecological model. I think almost everyone is, but just very briefly, we know it all starts at the heart with sort of the individual. And really when Daniela gave her examples, She was really talking about thinking about wayfinding as an individual concept. And I think many of us begin to think about that, how we navigate and sort of the focus on us. But we want to broaden that focus of wayfinding to think of also groups of individuals who are wayfinding. You can think of a walking group. You can think of a bicycle club. You can think of lots of groups, in a sense, that have to navigate and find their way through different environments. You can think of communities, and you can think of how communities can impact and influence wayfinding. You can think of then influential sectors, such as urban planners and others, who influence that environment in transit. And then also systems and policy interventions that could happen, and think about then again on how those would influence the wayfinding process. At the heart of our framework is actually the process itself in thinking about this. And so in the circle is really all the concepts of thinking about sort of wayfinding, and at the and at the heart, really, as I mentioned, begins with sort of thinking about individual people with sort of and the elements that people would be influenced by. So when we think of the resources that people have, one, we think of people physical or really their functioning. And for older adults in particular, there may be limited mobility or issues that they have to confront that could influence, you know, their work in the environment. And then we think of cognition. Again, if people have memory problems or they have executive function problems in navigating through the environment, as well as emotional, of how if someone has an upsetting day, you may not pay attention to where you parked your car and then having to rely on those. So all of those people kinds of functions. And this is in the context, though, of thinking about the community environment. And so most of you are probably familiar with what we think of person-environment fit theory, that it's not just the person or the environment, but how those two interact. So the community environment is really sort of lays that platform in thinking about these issues. And the community environment, though, is not a single entity. It actually has multiple components that people have studied in this sense of place. And some of those are the built environment. How has the environment been structured and laid out? We can think about the social environment. What's it like in that community? How do people feel about the community? How do people know and have linkages in the community? We can think about the natural community. Are there rivers? Are there barriers? Are there bridges? Are there things that the community has been built around or that environment needs to take into account? We can even think in the natural environment, whether it's warm all the time or whether it snows, and those are going to have influences on thinking about that. And then the population characteristics. Is this a community that is a wealthy community or a community which is lower socioeconomic? And so thinking about, in a sense, resources and assets the community itself may have, and then the policies that the community have. I happen to live in Decatur, Georgia, which was just named as one of the top 10 communities in the United States for walkability. And again, they have set in policies for thinking about, structural planning and looking at the built environment and some of these aspects. But many communities didn't rank in that top 10. So again, the challenges. So it's a complex kind of thing of thinking about the community environment. And of particular interest within the context of this whole broad environment is the trip environment. And when we think about this as a component of what is it that the goals that people have for thinking about that particular event or thing that they're going on. And so when we think of the trip environment, I want to point out it's not just people walking, which this picture shows, but it could be people wheeling in wheelchairs, it could be bicycling, it could be driving. So the trip environment depends, again, on the modes of transport that people have, but also the goals. Are you walking for exercise? Are you planning to get to work? And so those kinds of things may influence, in a sense, that experience that you have, as well as how familiar you are. When I first arrived here and I had to navigate, I've been here since Sunday, so I'm pretty familiar now with the building and it's pretty easy to locate. But the first time you come into an unfamiliar environment, it takes a while to navigate and find your way through. And that's same in neighborhoods and communities. So oftentimes people who are very familiar and living in a neighborhood they may not think about sort of the wayfinding because they're familiar. But once they go to a new environment or they go out of that more comfortable one, it can be very confusing. So those are some important aspects of the trip environment. We can also think, as I had mentioned, sort of the person-environment fit. And in wayfinding, sort of what are those things about people and then the trip environment itself that can interact. And we have done some work, and you'll hear some more work, in thinking about sort of safety issues and other issues. And some important pieces are to think about user tools and technologies. And these can either be tools used by people, when we think of people using canes or other kinds of assistive devices, or in tools and technologies that actually come from the environment. So we can support people both through tools and environmental as well as person-oriented tools. The third component are public health outcomes: mobility, safety, engagement, access, economic vitality, and health, which you'll hear more about from our other speakers. So together, this is the conceptual framework that we have developed to help understand all the multifaceted and complex nature of that. So really, the use of this framework can help us develop research questions. It can help and assist in designing, implementing, and assessing public health strategies intended. So again, not taking into account the complexity can affect our interventions. And while we've used it, is to help us to organize our review of literature to say what's known and what needs to be known about this concept of wayfinding. So with that, I want to turn it over to our next speaker. Anna Vandenberg from Emory University.
Hello, everyone, and thank you so much for finding your way here. Today I'm going to talk about cross-disciplinary research perspectives on community wayfinding. I have no financial relationships to disclose. This is our core research team. Wayfinding has many research traditions have grappled with wayfinding from at least the early 20th century, anthropology, architecture, urban planning. We noticed that public health was not among this list. Public health has done a great job of researching the built environment and healthy communities, but it tends to focus on how people move through environments physically, leaving unaddressed their informational needs, and we think you can't separate the two. We did a scoping review of the literature on community wayfinding, and here was our process. We selected databases and search terms. We developed inclusion and exclusion criteria, screened abstracts, and then we extracted elements from the articles that we selected using a standard form. And then we broke into groups that were person-environment tools and also a person-environment fit group. And we analyzed the themes of those articles, and we prepared a manuscript. Here are the databases we searched. We used the term wayfinding and similar spellings. We started with more than 1,000 articles, and we whittled the list down to 669. We ended up with 201 publications that we considered appropriate for review, excluding articles on indoor environments, emergency evacuation, basic science, computer navigation articles, product development, and clinical articles. The majority of the articles looked at community wayfinding from the point of view of people, 64. There was a group that looked at environmental design features for wayfinding. About 46 articles dealt with the person-environment interaction piece, and 53 looked at tools and technology. Here were our key questions. First, what is community wayfinding? Second, what do we know about the environment and community wayfinding? Third, what do we know about people and community wayfinding? And we also looked at tools in community wayfinding. And then what do we know about the interaction among all of these elements? And then fifth, what is a reasonable theoretical conceptual formulation of community wayfinding from a public health perspective? And finally, what are the implications for research, policy, practice, and interdisciplinary collaboration? So here are our findings. Wayfinding, the literature told us that community wayfinding is a problem-solving, process, and we're talking here about outdoor complex environments, and that there are four main components: orientation, or knowing where you are; decision making, which looks at trip planning. So, for example, what is the fastest route or the safest route to get to the grocery store and back? Route selection, which might be, oops, I'm late, or I don't want to go that way. What is a shortcut that I can take quickly? Path integration, which is more of a sensory experience. So what is my body telling me about whether I'm on track or not? And closure, have I arrived yet? The people literature looked at people's resources and capacities for a community wayfinding, and it was based largely on the information processing model in psychology, which looks at an analogy between computers and humans, and information comes in, it's processed, and then acted upon. So it's very important that people can perceive information through their senses, vision, hearing, and so forth. It's important that they be able to hold that some information in their head as they move through environments and work with that information when new information is coming in. It's important that they draw on memories of familiar environments that they have been in, and it's important that they can use strategies that they've worked out in the past that to keep them going. Now, the environment, we live in a very complex urban environment these days, so what does environmental literature say? The environmental literature looked at environments as providing information. So Lynch, Linda mentioned Kevin Lynch, the urban planner. He talked about five key elements when he did qualitative research on what people noticed about cities and what they remembered, and came up with five key elements. Other people, like Tommy Garling and others, have talked about the importance of coherent layouts to guide people, and that signage can't really overcome poor layouts. However, signage and what we call support systems for wayfinding, especially that coordinate you the pedestrian with the transit rider and so forth, are very, very helpful. So we've talked a little bit about people's needs for information, and we've talked about how the environment is a source of information. But community wayfinding is really an interaction between the two. So the field of environmental psychology has been particularly helpful here in following people as they move through environments and actually talking with them and listening to what they're saying in a moment-by-moment way and what decisions they're making and how they're changing what they're doing based on environmental conditions. So that they have told us that it's a very dynamic process. In that people do react to the environment. They avoid places that are confusing to them. And one interesting, very interesting area of research is how people offload thinking onto the environment. So they will use a landmark as a directional beacon. And I relate to that because I lived in Toronto for a while and I relied totally on the CN Tower to wherever I was, get off and walk straight towards that. And then also they notice things at intersections and other decision points and pretty much forget everything else in between and go on autopilot. So those are some general processes of wayfinding that are kind of universal. But another layer of complexity is that people differ greatly. There are huge individual differences in wayfinding ability, and this has to do with physical differences, sensory differences, and differing cognitive abilities. There's also an interesting concept that emerged from the literature that is a good sense of direction. And so people do have a sense that they are good or bad at finding their way, and it tends to be pretty accurate. So that's interesting as well, that spatial anxiety does predict more navigational errors. And people will actually make people avoid going outside altogether, moving about. The literature talks about five and possibly six vulnerable populations who may need special needs. So first, people with visual impairment. People who are blind do form representations of their environments. It takes them longer to learn environments sometimes. People with mobility impairments have trouble for a variety of reasons. One is visual, in that if they're in a wheelchair or walking in a walker, it's hard to see landmarks and other cues. And also, we find increasingly that needs for mobility, the need to concentrate on moving and just simply walking as one gets older, competes with the need to concentrate on where you're going. People with cognitive impairments, as we know, people with Alzheimer's disease often get lost, but people with mild cognitive impairment also have trouble finding their way in especially unfamiliar environments. They have a lot of difficulty suppressing distractions. And the literature, the architect, Remedy Pacini, talks about how all of us actually do have transient cognitive impairment. I think we can all relate to that. If we're tired, if we're under stress, if there's too much bombardment from the environment, we get into that situation where it's very difficult to stay focused, and disorientation tends to have a physiological arousal response that makes it much more difficult. Another vulnerable population is children who whose abilities are not fully formed until about age 12. Older adults, of course, because they often, too, fall into several of these categories. They may have trouble moving, they may have visual impairment, and they may have cognitive impairment. But also, it's just difficult when you're dealing with even mild decline in those areas, if they're all happening at the same time, to keep going. We found the literature was a bit obsessed with sex differences. This was very interesting, and a lot of the studies were lab-based with virtual environments and focused on a very small piece of the movement. So we'd like to know more about whether this relates to wayfinding the actual world and to what degree it matters. We were left with these research questions, which we think public health can help us with. First, what roles do good or poor wayfinding environments play in physical activity, behavior, transit use, social and community engagement, and motor vehicle injury prevention? How does community environment use over the life course develop or maintain community wayfinding abilities? Do community wayfinding differences exist based on race or ethnicity, cultural background, levels of education or income, or preferred language? And what is the prevalence of community wayfinding-related spatial anxiety? How does it relate to travel avoidance and social isolation? So thank you very much.
Doing some negotiating around wayfinding.
Good morning. I'm Cindy Bryant from the Colorado School of Public Health, and I'm so glad you joined us here to share what we have learned. I have no relevant information to disclose and will avoid boring you with the irrelevant. I want to share the co-authors of this particular study, with particular notice to David Marquez, who is the principal investigator of this study. He cannot be here today, so I don't quite look like him, but pretend I'm David. Okay, this we're talking about, you know, you've just heard a lot about conceptual and literature review and things like that. I have the fun of telling you about an on-the-ground real-world exploration of wayfinding with a set of older adults in South Chicago. I suppose I should go in. Anyway, here's the setting. This is South Chicago, Lake Michigan to the east. South Chicago has a higher percentage of older adults, at least in this neighborhood, than in many other settings, and a very diverse cultural environment. So we recruited older adults in South Chicago, people who lived in assisted living facilities, community settings, places of that nature. The item on the left is the flyer that was used to reach people. The criteria were being aged 65 or older, being able to walk or wheel independently in the community, being proficient in English, because there was a survey piece, and having lived in the community at least for a year, because we wanted to know how they get around in that neighborhood. The methods. This is a multi-method study. It involved a structured survey-based interview. It involved a semi-structured piece that we will talk more about, and a task walk. The folks who joined the study, 35 older adults, were either long-time or short-time residents, and we did try to include people with some mild level of cognitive limitations, but not everybody. So the interview. The structured part of the interview included demographics, functional status, the modes of transportation that people used, and some other just basic information. The semi-structured interview addressed those things that Anna was talking about, the components of community wayfinding. What preferred route did people use? How did they make decisions about it? And that was related to the different kinds of modes of transportation they use. We completed the interview by asking people to draw a map of South Chicago. So here's just to give you a picture of the map drawing. Most of the maps either looked like the one on the left, which is a bird's eye view, what we would call a spatial map in good old community wayfinding literature, in the kinds of things that Anna was talking about, or a route map. This is how I would get from here to there. This is my neighborhood, and here's the store, and there's the, you know, there's the church I go to, and walking along like that, pointing out landmarks rather than this sort of global spatial view of the neighborhood. Then people went on a task walk. The researcher, using an iPad to take down information, said, "We're going on a short walk now. I will guide you, but I want you to pay attention so that you would be able to give directions to a friend who was not familiar with the area." The area had previously, the researchers had previously surveyed the area using the Healthy Aging Network environmental walkability tool and selected a path that included both high and low wayfinding cues. While walking, the interviewer would pause, but people did not know where they were headed. It was the YMCA, so they were told, "We're going to cross the street now, we're going to turn right now," or whatever. And we asked them to tell about what they noticed along the way, what kinds of barriers there might be, how they knew where, would ask them, "Do you know where you are? I mean, how would you say where you are right now?" And then periodically throughout the walk, and then at the end, we said, "Okay, how would you tell your friend to get where we are now?" So that was the purpose of the task walk. So results. Who participated? 35 older adults participated. You can see the racial and ethnic diversity. The age, most people were between 65 and 74. Income, low to middle, and education pretty split. A few used mobility aids, and 7 people we determined to have some kind of cognitive limitation, either because of the mini-cog test that they took, or because they said when asked, "I have some problems with memory," or when interviewer, the person who walked the path with them, was observing them and talking to them, if that person felt that there was some cognitive limitation. So this is not a formal diagnostic issue, but just to give some idea. We wanted to know if it made a difference. So here are the key questions that I'm going to talk about. These are not the only questions that the study considered, but how do people plan their routes? What features support how they make decisions along the way? So how do they plan ahead of time? What do they do while they're en route? And which factors influence successful wayfinding? So here is the information about the preferred route. This is what people said. And note how much comes from talking with other people and how little comes from things like GPS and phones. The route planning components, the kind of pre-planners, I think about it ahead of time. Askers, I just ask people. I ask the bus driver, I ask a friend who's been there. And explorers, and it was an interesting number of people who said, I don't ask, I sort of know the area, I just prowl around and figure it out. Wayfinding features. What were the features that helped people find their way? Again, landmarks, street signs seem to be the predominant method. So it's not mapping, it is items that they could see along the way. Features en route, similarly, landmarks, street signs. A little bit related to safety, but perhaps less than we might have expected to hear about safety. And helpful features. What helped you find your way? The addresses, forget them. It's the buildings that I remember. And then landmarks and hearing information from other people. Interesting that asking somebody in a gas station or something, ask more than one person because one person might give you misleading information. Interesting. What's confusing in a new place? We ask that explicitly. Questions of poor cues. The street signs are missing. There's nothing to really orient me. Distractions. And I think I've gotten turned around because I stopped to listen to a conversation, realized I'd gone three blocks beyond when I'm driving and had to go back. Lack of familiarity, just not knowing where I am, not knowing how far I need to go. Confusing street alignments. Boston's a good place for that. And transportation-related issues. So how successful were the participants in being able to, in being oriented, to knowing where they were and being able to tell somebody else how to get there? 80% of the respondents gave correct orientation responses each time along the task walk when they were asked, where are you? Well, I'm at the corner of Hollywood and Vine or whatever. And 50, just a little over half, gave correct directions for a friend. Now, that's a bit subjective, I guess, as to what's a correct response, but we did look at that very carefully. The results, we only had 35 people, and we can't really make distinctions among the groups, those who had lived there for a short time and a longer time, or those with or without cognitive limitations or different kinds of mobility needs. So we really look forward to opportunities to do more research. Takeaways, turning how people plan. As I said, that just they talk to other people. They get information from others. Some discussion about safety-related issues. I don't go too far. You just have to be watching yourself all the time. Go with somebody else, so be careful. Then in terms of the takeaway messages from what they did on the path when they were on the way, it was important to have clear naming and numbering of streets and locations, and that landmarks are really a special help. If there's a building that's noticeable, as Anna was talking about, or I live in Denver, I know where the mountains are. I know that's west. I can get oriented. Study limitations. South Chicago may, in fact, have a much more legible, to use Kevin Lynch's term, legible system of signage. The streets, it really is a grid, and some of the streets are numbered so you know how far you've gone, and it really is easier. And we had a very small number of participants. So thank you.
Good morning. I have no disclosures to announce. I wanted to first recognize our team. This represents diverse disciplines as well as a number of different universities as well as both junior and senior investigators in the field. Ensuring effective community wayfinding is critical for maintaining mobility among older adults. Reduced mobility associated with either age or disability is a concern to individuals and also a major public health burden. So the purpose of this presentation, then, is to discuss our preliminary findings from a systematic review we conducted on the role of user tools and technologies in facilitating community wayfinding in older adults and people with mobility disabilities. This diagram is a component of the integrated conceptual framework of community wayfinding that was shown earlier by Dr. Anderson. In this component of the framework, technologies are based at the intersection between individual capacity on one hand and environmental challenges and demands on the other. And technology, in the best of circumstances, is designed to enhance individual capacity and to address environmental challenges to improve wayfinding. This approach to the role of technology served as the basis for our review. So for our purpose, we define wayfinding user tools and technologies as those devices and systems then that enhance the ability of individuals and populations to locate themselves, to know where they are, and find their way safely through indoor and outdoor environments with ease, efficiency, and effectiveness. We focused our review on four types of wayfinding technologies. User-based technologies are technologies that are controlled by the user. Examples might include a mobile phone, a computer, or a car-based GPS. Environment-based technologies are technologies that are part of the indoor or outdoor environment, such as an audible beacon or an environmental sensor. User-environment interactive technologies are those technologies that allow communication between user-based and environmental-based technologies. That might be such as an environmental sensor that's linked to a handheld device. Wayfinding systems are information or management systems that are most typically community or transportation related. An example may be a citywide real-time transportation information system. So we had four questions. Two of them I will be presenting to you today in exploring what are innovative wayfinding technologies that exist or that are emerging so that adults can better find their way. And then what are the implications of wayfinding technology and dissemination for public health? So on this schematic, you can see our steps that we used in our review. I wanted to highlight a couple. We did develop and pilot a 38-item abstraction tool and also developed a reviewer's guide to go with it. The key inclusion criteria that we used for our review were articles related to community wayfinding that were published within the last 10 years, and they could either be a research study or they could be a review, a guideline, or using some other format. We were looking at technologies that were used either indoor, outdoor, or in virtual spaces. We were also interested in technologies that facilitated wayfinding and then wayfinding that was related to transportation modes and systems. We ran our search with the help of a university-based librarian, and the resulting papers were reviewed and abstracted both by primary reviewers and secondary reviewers. Any discrepancies between the primary and secondary reviewers we reconciled, and then we extracted the findings, and now we're in the process of analyzing and sharing them. So our process is shown on this schematic. We identified over 591 records. We excluded 485 for the reasons listed on the right side of this slide. With the remaining 106 records, we conducted both primary and secondary abstractions as well as reconciliations. And then through the abstract process, we then eliminated an additional 23, so the total excluded were 508, and my report here is on the remaining 83. So the next several slides deal with our main findings. We examined then each article to determine what area of wayfinding was addressed. So as shown on this slide, navigation was the largest area with 87% of the articles focused on navigation. So an example of navigation might be an audio and visual wayfinding aids that help individuals find their way towards a destination. As all you, many of you know, navigation really is about reducing the uncertainty about our trips that we take. Orientation was the next, and that was addressed in 46% of the articles. An example of orientation may be the use of a GPS. Route planning was the next category. It allows one to plan a route ahead of time, and this was addressed in 41% of our articles. And fascinating route planning systems that are being developed. Some of you may have used them. But one example is the use of smart parking technologies at park and ride transit stations. Anyone use those? Okay. So, in fact, navigation is helping you get to a certain point. But what we know is that consumers also want to know what happens when they get to their destination. And, in fact, those people who are driving like to know in advance whether there are going to be parking places and how you're going to actually pay once you get to your destination. So these smart parking technologies actually integrate navigation along with parking price and guidance to your spot, as well as providing you information about transit or airport connections, should that be what you're interested in. Closure, then, is determining when you have arrived at an intended destination or a stopping point when exploring. And this was addressed in 23% of the articles. And one example of closure is an automatic landmark detection system. And this includes landmark destinations in the technologies rather than just buildings or addresses. And then path integration, this was in 22% of the articles, and this is the physical and mental experience of remembering movement along a path. And this is really critical for public health, because here an example is one of the articles that discussed people who use their mobile phones, GPSs, and that they often are unaware of their surroundings or their movement along a path because they are fixated on their GPS. And what we're concerned about is their overall reliance on the technology to keep track of a route that then makes them unaware of their surroundings. What types of articles? We found the predominant number ones were empirical at 45%. These included frequently proof of concept papers or product testing, but we also did locate quasi-experimental at 22% and RCTs, randomized clinical trials, at 8%. The other category actually included things such as conference proceedings or guidelines. What was the setting? It was a mixture between outdoor, indoor, and virtual, but clearly outdoor was the most frequently used site in the articles we reviewed. And then we also looked at the type of technologies that were addressed. The most frequent technology was user-based, and this was at 71%. So again, an example might be a handheld augmented reality system that actually shows a virtual point of interest. So you would actually have a device, you would point it to a real-world item and part of the environment, and then on your screen it would be augmented with additional information. We also found user environment interface was the next most frequent, and this might include cell phones that interface with environmental beacons. Wayfinding was next at 14%. These are typically complex technologies then that focus on community or transportation-related wayfinding. And then we also did find some environment-based technologies, but this was the least frequently addressed at 10%. An example might be an environment-based technology, including a beacon-accessible pedestrian signal. And then we also looked at how much did our articles address functional factors. Vision was the most frequently addressed at 43%. This might include an auditory intersection signal for pedestrians with visual impairments. We also noted that cognition was addressed in 24% of the articles, Again, this might include technology then that addresses cognitive impairment, that has a location-specific memory cue that's triggered by comparing a current GPS coordinate location with the expected route coordinates that you obtain from stored route databases. And then less frequently, hearing, dexterity, and balance was addressed. So we had some key observations. Our team came up with these. I think we saw studies that did focus on sensory deficits, including vision impairment, cognitive dysfunction, and mild dementia, but few studies related to older adults. But although there was multiple disciplines who were conducting these studies, it was clear they addressed the implications for older adults. These were studies, many of them had small sample sizes, but little attention was also given to the social economic barriers. So as a result of these observations, we do have some proposed new directions. In particular, we need to better understand the use of wayfinding technologies in everyday settings. I think important for all of us at APHA is these new directions really need to include an examination to what extent wayfinding technology enhances mobility, physical activity, access to goods and services, and other health behaviors in the population. We also need to address safety, to what extent and under what circumstances particular types of wayfinding technologies, for example, the use of handheld mobile devices and GPS, are distracting and thus elevating the risks of falls and crashes. And then we also need to look at accessibility and social demographic uptake of community wayfinding technologies. And we're also proposing that from the outset we have better collaborations between the wayfinding developers and our public health professionals. And to this end then, research will provide important information about the role of wayfinding technology in future public health interventions to enhance population health. And so in closing, any of you from Boston here? Any of you Paul Revere fans, do you want to read or say with me, what's the next slide? Aha, Paul Revere, there he is. The first eight lines of Longfellow. So have you memorized this? Listen, my children, and you shall hear on the midnight ride of Paul Revere on the 18th of April in 75. Hardly a man is now alive who remembers that famous day and year. He said to his friend, if the British march by land or sea from the town tonight, hang a lantern aloft in the belfry arch on the northern church tower as the signal light, one if by land, two if by sea, and I on the opposite shore will be ready to ride and spread the alarm. So thank you very much.
All righty. Good morning, everyone. Thanks so much for being here. On behalf of my co-authors on this abstract, I am delighted to see you here. We're hoping to inspire people to get involved in this particular topic and move forward toward improved community wayfinding. I have no exotic relationships to disclose, unfortunately, or lucrative. So I'm going to share a little bit with you about our approach to looking at policy and practice in this area. I'm going to do a uber quick highlighting of some of the issues in wayfinding in U.S. communities, talk about some of our thoughts in terms of a general approach to improving community wayfinding, and again, I hope interest you in becoming involved in some way in your community or area of practice. So, in order to capture current policy and practice, we essentially took two steps. One, we convened an expert panel of people who are knowledgeable about community wayfinding from their particular discipline or profession. So we had architecture, transportation, universal design, engineering, planning, and also public health experts who contributed to this work. We were fortunate to be able to do a librarian search as well of not only traditional sources, but also the gray literature. So looking at conference proceedings, policy briefs, and even blogs. So for example, the Atlantic Cities has done an excellent blog on wayfinding that's really quite interesting. And then taking the information gleaned from these two steps, using a snowball approach to identify other sources that we might want to look at. So then to integrate all of this information, we initially prepared abstractions of this material and organized it into a compendium on community wayfinding. And that particular compendium is available to you on the Healthy Aging Research Network website, which is on the little bookmark that Basha shared with you. Expert panel members also prepared from the perspective of their discipline brief summaries, highlighting problems, different approaches, and their recommendations for moving forward. We then moved into a synthesis phase, and we convened what our expert panel called the cross-fertilization meeting, the purpose of which was to share perceptions from different disciplines and then to achieve consensus in terms of what would be necessary in order to improve community wayfinding here in the U.S. Subsequently, we moved into a products phase, and I'll say a little bit more about that in a few minutes. But first, we want to give you a bit of a sampling of what we learned through this process. But first, I'd kind of like to frame the whole area in terms of this being kind of a perfect, if you will, opportunity for public health engagement. So perfect in the sense that it's a great fit. So whether you're focused on physical activity, injury prevention, aging, children, healthy communities, I think that the concept of community wayfinding is relevant and can contribute to our goals in all of those areas. It's also perfect because wayfinding is ubiquitous. I mean, all of our communities have a structure and a budget to deal with wayfinding, okay? And that's another reason that's perfect, because there's a budget. So how often can you say that you can have a public health impact without a vast new infusion of new funding, okay? So the money's being spent, and we may as well get a public health angle on it. We can help with that. So all that being said, is the public health perspective needed relative to policy and practice? And I think we would all argue that absolutely that's needed. So if you look at what's happening right now, what communities are doing, you'll see that their primary focus is typically one of looking at economic activity in the community, fostering economic activity, or in terms of identity and branding, or simple transportation issues like traffic flow through the community or transit issues. There's only very recently begun to be attention directed toward pedestrian and bicycle wayfinding. And that's an area where we can definitely spend some time and perhaps get more out of the money that's being spent, if you will, so that there's a better use of what are essentially public funds. So here's a quick look at the wayfinding landscape from the perspective of the major players or the different professional groups that have expertise in community wayfinding. And when you look at that, what do you see? Is there anything missing there? Public health, yeah. So I think we need to get public health into that picture. Is there anything else you notice when you look at that? So I think this is an issue, what I see, that's probably very familiar for those of you who work in the built environment arena or with healthy communities, and that's that all these people are focused on community wayfinding, but you don't see interaction depicted among them. And that is definitely problematic in terms of improving wayfinding. On top of that particular problem, you have these discipline-specific differences in terms of language and jargon and areas of focus and emphasis. You have vast jurisdictional differences, everything from, you know, the national all the way down to individual residential developments that right now are being developed in communities all across our country. you have as well a situation there, very, very spotty guidelines and best practices to direct people, and certainly a regrettable absence of integrated perspectives and planning. And I know that planning is a concern for many of you here, so wayfinding is an area where that's greatly needed. So, do all of these kinds of issues have an impact on the quality of community wayfinding? Well, absolutely they do. I think one terrific example in the area of jurisdictional differences is the study that was done in London a few years back that discovered that within the city there were actually 32 different wayfinding systems. And for those of you who were in London in that period, you can probably speak to the degree to which things like that are really confusing. Again, the issue of guidelines and best practices being relatively well developed in some areas like motor vehicle transportation, accessibility, but poorly developed in others, notably pedestrian wayfinding. And then this whole issue of the inconsistencies from community to community, and even within communities. So I think it's clear that the quality of the wayfinding environment typically becomes poorer the further that you move from a city center. There are fewer resources devoted there. On a more positive note, we have a number of beacons or exemplary initiatives, if you will, that are going on all across the world. Surely the Legible Cities Initiative is one that's really exciting. These are typically large-scale, visionary efforts to totally transform wayfinding within particular communities. And the cool thing about this is very often there is a public health agenda that is a part of that work, as well as these other issues of promoting economic and commercial interests. We're also increasingly seeing wayfinding kinds of issues being integrated into master plans, into pedestrian and bicycle plans, and also some public health integration here in the U.S. Nashville's Communities Putting Prevention to Work initiative, Nash Vitality, has a very creative approach to integrating wayfinding with promoting physical activity. There are even what are called stealth or guerrilla citizen action initiatives to improve community wayfinding. And you see one of those depicted in the bottom photo there that's from Raleigh, North Carolina, that was subsequently accepted by the city and integrated into their overall plan. So I mentioned products, and I want to make you aware that we will soon be releasing a document called Pathways to Better Community Wayfinding, and we're really hoping this will be part of a major dissemination process to really create a lot of cross-sector dialogue about this topic with the goal of really trying to foster a more integrated approach across transportation modes to improve mobility for people of all ages and ability. The contents are really draw upon all the things that we've been talking about this morning, common wayfinding pitfalls, why it's important, how it works, best practices, kind of what communities are doing now, some of the promising new directions, and of course, recommendations. And I want to just kind of give you a quickie look at some of the general recommendations that are in Pathways. One is certainly, you know, we'd like to see communities embrace a broader vision of wayfinding than they currently have. There's really, you know, great opportunities to kind of tweak what's being done now to add a broader vision, to add public health to the mix. So if you think of street side maps, for example, that you're beginning to see in many communities, it's very easy to put a circle on that map that shows people where they can walk within 5, 10, or 15 minutes. And that's the kind of thing that helps people make decisions about walking and certainly can help promote it. Some of the other key recommendations that are elaborated on in the document have, again, to do with integrated transportation planning, interjurisdictional planning, designed for all users rather than just the average user, systems for asset management, certainly assessment and evaluation of what's happening in communities so that in turn we can take that information, further develop and refine it over time and create better guidelines and standards in this area. We are absolutely delighted and honored to already have several outstanding partner organizations who are going to be involved in the dissemination of pathways. And we, again, we're hoping that some of you will choose to join us as well. We're planning a very action-oriented dissemination. Our mantra, knowledge is fine, but action is divine. Okay? So we've been very much involved in what I think we can think of as kind of a sense-making process as far as wayfinding is concerned. And probably those of you who are participating in the symposium this morning, you know, have also been trying to make sense of this wayfinding thing and how is it relevant to my work. So this is a really important piece. We certainly want to be able to move from that into building kind of a community of practice which will drive change. And as part of that, to work on ways to improve policy and practice, to evaluate that and reconfigure as necessary. So also want to mention, you know, again, we've been kind of involved in this communal effort, and one of the really exciting things, I think, about the evaluation, that's the dissemination that's going to be coming up is that each of our partnering organizations will be tailoring some dissemination work to their particular constituencies. So ITE, for example, that's the Institute for Transportation Engineers, they're planning to do a journal article for the engineering community, perhaps to create a standards document that would be a complement to Pathways, and then to integrate some sort of process for monitoring change. ICAA, which is the International Council for Active Aging, also planning a journal article and perhaps creating a companion document for active living communities relative to improving wayfinding. So I think these are really exciting pieces of a dissemination effort that hopefully will put some teeth into this and really help us see what we hope to see, and that is some action, some change, to improve wayfinding. As it exists now, community wayfinding is a bit of a maze in many places, but we're hoping that together we can find the way, and certainly hoping that some of you will be able to join us in that effort. You are most welcome. Thank you. Now for discussion.